grab your coat and snatch your hat. Leave your worries on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street. Can't you hear that pitter-pat? And that happy tune is your step. Life can be so sweet on the sunny side of the street. I used to walk in the shade with the blues on parade. No longer afraid, the rover crossed over. If I never had a cent, I'll be rich as Rockefeller. The gold dust at my feet on the sunny side of the street. I used to walk in the shade with those blues on parade. But I'm not afraid, 'cause the rover, he got over. If I never had a cent, I'd be rich as Rockefeller. All those chicks round my feet on the sunny side of the street.
White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker. North Central Indiana, right here. The date is March 24th, 2015, and it's Tears Day. And you can thank your lucky stars you're on walking on a sunny side of the street if your body's not in 50 million pieces laying all over the side of a mountain in the French Alps this morning. Like all those 140, 150 people that bit the dust over there in France, I believe it was. Another crisis. You know how that works? Every day there's got to be a new crisis. Now, it may be interesting or may not. It's not really interesting to me to hear it 5,000 million times about this plane that went down in the Alps. Now, if the plane went down here in north central Indiana, that would be of concern to me. I don't know. I don't think I'd be running out there to look it over, but still, you get more news than you need. And more news than I could handle. Every time anything happens in the world, it's a crisis. 9 million TV stations and radio stations are talking about it and talking about it and talking about it and talking about it. Interesting to watch these pictures from coming in from over there. See dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of vans standing by, rescue vans. Well, a plane that lost that much altitude that fast and dove into the mountains of the Alp Mountains, you're not going to be needing any vans to haul live people away. Anyhow, the main thing I get out of this is what parasites the press are. They're absolute raving parasites of the worst order. Also, they keep showing the same scenes over and over and over ad nauseum. I mean, it's unbelievable. All the channels do it. Now, as your personal security advocate, I wanted to read you something here or tell you about it. I've told you a million times that when anybody comes around you that wants to talk to you about anything serious, you can be sure they've got a digital tape recorder on them. And now they'll have the mini cameras on them. So in Ferguson, the suspect confessed on a hidden camera. That's what the warrant. This is the guy that shot the cops. A confidential informant wearing hidden video camera recorded accused gunman Jeffrey L. Williams admitting that he fired the shots that seriously wounded two police officers. Yeah. Just a second here. I'll get you some more information. Well, this fellow named Williams, this black fellow, a Negro, was arrested on March 15th and charged with two counts of first-degree assault, one count of firing a weapon from a vehicle, and three counts of armed criminal action. That's interesting. A count for firing a weapon from an automobile? What the hell's the difference? That's weird. Okay, at a news conference announcing the arrest, St. Louis County Prosecutor Robert McCullough said that Williams' confession was key to bringing the charges, but declined to give details on how the admission was obtained. Well, let's go down here and see if we can find out how it was obtained. Let's see. Details of the confidential informant and the hidden camera confession come from warrants that investigators obtained to search a car that Williams was allegedly driving the night of the shooting and his girlfriend's apartment. According to the affidavit supported by the warrant, a Ferguson detective received a phone call from a confidential informant on March 14 saying that Williams was claiming to be the shooter that police were actively seeking. The informant is not named in the affidavit, but investigators note that their anonymous source, quote, has proven reliable through previous law enforcement investigation. In other words, it's been a snitch that must live in the community, must be acquainted with the people charged. And I'm telling you now that if you're involved in anything naughty, you can't talk about it to anybody. Nobody. Nobody. Not your mama, not your daddy, not your brother, not your sister, not your kid, not your wife, not your neighbors, not to the people at church, not to the people in the bar, and the list goes on and on. Because if you do, one of them's either a confidential informant or will become an informant later on. And it's not good to do that anyhow, because then you endanger the freedom of other people that have nothing to do with whatever you have something to do with, if you had something to do with it. Williams was in an older model red Pontiac Grand Am just after midnight when he fired three shots in the direction of the Ferguson Police Department, according to the charges filed. I assume this was with a pistol. It might not have been, but if he shot from any distance, must have been a pretty good shot, because I guess he got two of them. Two of the three shots struck officers who were standing in a police riot line. Well, I guess there was so many cops there that you couldn't miss. You had to hit somebody. The shots, police said, were believed to have been fired from a spot about 125 yards away on a side street across from the police department. Well, that's pretty good shooting. An intense three-day manhunt after the shooting yielded no suspects and little for investigators to go on, okay? Quote, I cannot tell you this time that an arrest is imminent, unquote, St. Louis County Police Chief John Belmar said 42 hours into the search. But detectives caught a break when the informant stepped forward on March 14th, and I'm sure he had something to gain. Usually informants have been under indictment, all kinds of stuff, and they've made a deal with the cops to turn informant. Or it's just plain cash. A lot of informants work for money. The source was outfitted with a hidden camera and sent to the apartment of Williams' girlfriend. According to the affidavit, Williams went outside and got into the front passenger seat of a car driven by the informant. Stupid. Stupid. The pair drove through the North St. Louis County while discussing the shooting. Double stupid, double stupid. They ultimately went to Ferguson and the location where the shots were fired. Went back to the scene. Quote, the suspect then told the confidential source, informant, that he discharged a handgun at unknown individuals from an area which was consistent with the location of the fired cartridge casings, the affidavit alleged. In an email, Christmas told Yahoo News, we are unaware of a confidential informant and the recorded statement, unquote. Well, of course, they're going to tell you that initially. Quote, I can't comment on any of this information until I see the tape and have an opportunity to depose the informant, Christmas said. Williams, according to the warrant, also admitted to the police source that he still had the 40 caliber handgun used in the shooting. You know why there's so many Negroes in prison? Well, it's obvious why. If you watch some of these cop shows where they get them into the interrogation room, you'll know in 5 seconds why there's so many blacks in a joint. It's not because of what they've done. In most cases, it's what they say. The confidential informant drove Williams back to his girlfriend's apartment after... See, here's my words. After he got all the information he needed to get him arrested, the informant left and a surveillance team set up to watch the apartment, which is located about 4 miles east of Ferguson Police Department. About 10:30 on March 15th, Williams walked out of the apartment towards the same red Pontiac Grand Am he had allegedly driven the night of the shooting. He didn't get rid of the car. Officers moved in and took Williams into custody. Williams, who has already wanted for violating his probation on unrelated theft case, was arrested without incident, according to a spokesman for the St. Louis County Police Department. So now you have to be concerned about hidden recorders. Of course, I always carry one. It saved my ass on different occasions. And if I'm having a conversation with someone, just a friend, I never turn it on, of course. But if I suspect, especially meeting a new person, always want to meet them in a public place and always record the conversation. Because 9 chances out of 10, that person may be a confidential informant from any branch of government. So anyhow... You've got the deal here. They'll take your picture while you confess to the crime. And then you'll wonder, well, how in the hell did I get caught? What am I doing in prison here? Shit, I can't figure that out. What you ought to do is call up on these black talk shows or even some of these progressive shows and say, well, no, they're not in there just because they used pot or maybe had some cocaine. They're in there because they're stupid. And they run their mouth off and they get convicted. That's why there's so many blacks in prison. I know you're out there because I can hear you breathing. But take this to heart and never forget it. I don't care if it's a relative or who. Don't talk about things that you don't want them to tell the cops or anybody else. Just for your own privacy about anything important. Many things are important in your life that there's no need for... even some of your family to know about. So anyhow, every white activist that I know of that's in prison either had an informant next to them, or they were in a group where there were many informants all around them, or they were sleeping with some woman that was, she's going to become an informant, maybe be paid to be an informant, like with Dennis Mahan, or anything like that. And on the other hand, you'll see on these crime shows that many times a guy commits a really bad crime as a lone wolf type, an private individual, private contractor, and he disappears into the night, and most of the time they don't catch him, or they catch him 20 years later. A lot of serial killers get away with it because they operate by themselves, and they don't talk, and they don't leave a trail, and they get away with it maybe forever. But at least many of them get away with it for, maybe 20, 25, 30 years. Well, I see in the Israeli press that U.S.-Israel relations have been especially tense over the past several days, with U.S. President Barack Obama giving a particularly cold reception to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Nitwit, otherwise known as Nitwit, re-election last week. The many harsh statements that have been made over the past week are not in a vacuum. Well, I give you credit for that, Obama. I'm not like a lot of these white racists. If you do something that I think is a good thing and correct, then I'm going to tell you so, according to a senior diplomat who claims that the multiple condemnations are indeed a form of revenge from Obama administration against Nitwit. Quote, the White House has three main motives, unquote, the source explained to the newspaper. One, revenge for Nitwit's speech in Congress. Two, frustration. It's no secret that they were involved in an attempt to bring down Nitwit, and we know that clearly they have failed. Three, the government's attempt to shift the focus from them because of the negotiations with Iran to the Palestinian issue. According to the experts, Obama is specifically attempting to use deterioration in the Palestinian territories as an excuse to draw attention away from the disastrous and unpopular Iran nuclear deal, despite the fact that he knows that the only place preserving the stability of the Middle East at the moment is here. Well, anyhow, that's good, Obama. You could have gone a little farther, I think. Let's see if you had anything to say about this. In an interview of the recently published book Anti-Semitic Myths, a historical and contemporary anthology edited by Marvin Perry and Frederick M. Schweitzer, David Hirsch. Whoa, wait a minute. Here we go again. All right. David Hirsch has argued that it is a standard misreading of Marx to say that Marx was an anti-Semite. With this, he concurs with Robert Fine, who attempted to explode the myth of Marx's anti-Semitism. As far as Professor Fine is concerned, those who believe this myth have an inability to read Marx or comprehend Marx's ironic style of writing. Yeah, you're going to have to go a long way to disprove this, I'll tell you. What truth is there is in this argument? Marx's essay on the Jewish question, originally published in 1844, contains the following. Many of you people probably have read this. What is the worldly religion of the Jew? Huckstering. What is his worldly god? Money. Money is the jealous god of Israel, in face of which no other god may exist. Money degrades all gods of man and turns them into commodities. The bill of exchange is the real god of the Jew. His god is only an illusory bill of exchange. The chimerical nationality of the Jew is the nationality of the merchant, of the man of money in general. That seems pretty clear to me. Marx argues that the final analysis, the emancipation of the Jews, is the emancipation of mankind from Judaism. Larry Ray explains Marx's position is essentially as an assimilationist, one in which there is no room within emancipated humanity for Jews as a separate ethnic or cultural identity. Dennis Fishman puts it, Jews, Marx seems to be saying, can only become free when as Jews they no longer exist. Well, I think that's a good start. The British journalist and historian Paul Johnson has argued that the second part of Marx's essay is almost a classic anti-Semitic tract based upon a fancified Jewish archetype and a conspiracy to corrupt the world. You remember Karl Marx wrote that book too, A World Without Jews. I'm pretty sure he did. The American historian Gertrude Himmelfarb argued that it cannot be denied that in his essay on the Jewish question, Marx expressed views that were part of a classic repertoire of anti-Semitism. And so it goes on. Noted expert on anti-Semitism, Robert Wistrick, declared the net result of Marx's essay on the Jewish question is to reinforce a traditional anti-Jew stereotype. The identification of Jews with money-making in the sharpest possible manner. Okay. In his book Political Discourse in Exile, Karl Marx and the Jewish Question, Dennis Fishman comments that in the second section of his essay, quote, Marx seems fairly to bristle with anti-Jewish sentiments, unquote. Even the anti-Zionist Joel Kaval, whose political views I normally have no time for, has said, by anti-Semitism, I mean the denial of the right of the Jew to autonomously exist, i.e., to freely determine his or her own being as a Jew. Anti-Semitism, therefore, entails an attitude of hostility to the Jew as Jew. This is an act of violence addressed to an essential property of humanity, the assertion of an identity which may be understood as a socially shared structure of subjectivity. To attack the free assumption of identity is to undermine the social foundation of self. Judged by these criteria on the Jewish question is without any question an anti-Semitic tract. Significantly, only in its second part, no attempt to read these pages as a play on words can conceal the hostility when infuses them and is precisely directed towards the identity of the Jew. In fact, so commonly held is the view that Marx was an anti-Semite that in 1964, Shlomo Avineri, a leading commentator on Marx, stated, quote, Marx and Jewish emancipation, unquote, that Karl Marx was an inveterate anti-Semite is today considered a commonplace which is hardly ever questioned, despite the opinions of numerous commentators for the Professor Fine. Marx's stated views are not anti-Semitic, but witty and ironic in On the Jewish Question. Marx discusses the practical domination of Judaism over the Christian world. I'm not sure whether this is witty or ironic. Perhaps Professor Fine would like to explain. Marx's essay also contains accusations against the Jewish religion, which Marx says has contempt for theory, art, history, and for man as an end in himself. Witty? Ironic? I think not. Karl Marx would have made a good Nazi. In fact, he probably laid a lot of the framework that Hitler picked up on. To the credit of Professor Fine, he does not exonerate the left. Modern political anti-Semitism is a creature of the left as well as the right. But what he does not seem to do is disassociate the left anti-Semitism from Marx. Ulrich Meinhof of the Marxist Red Army faction posed this question, quote, how was Auschwitz possible? What was anti-Semitism? Unquote. And stated the opinion that Auschwitz means that 6 million Jews were murdered and carted on to the rubbish dumps of Europe for being that which was maintained of them, money Jews. Unquote. As far as she was concerned, hatred of the Jews was actually the hatred of capitalism, and hence the murder of the Israeli Olympic team in 1972, Munich Olympics, was not only justified, but something that could be praised While Meinhof's explanation is perverse, it seems to me that such an interpretation can be explained if one's understanding of how Marxists should view Jews is obtained from Marx's own essay on the Jewish question. When considering Marx and his views towards Jews, one must go further than his infamous essay. His correspondence also needs to be considered. Marx used the Bambergers to borrow money, but showed contempt for them. In a derogatory fashion, he referred to the father and the son as Jew Bamberger or Little Jew Bamberger. Similarly, Spielman, whose name appears frequently in correspondence between Marx and Engels, was referred to as Jew Spielman when on holiday in Ramsgate in 1879, Marx reported to Engels the resort contained as many Jews and fleas. In earlier letters to Engels, Marx referred to Ferdinand LaSalle as a Jewish nigger. Professor Fine has not discussed this, but I do not see such comments as witty or ironic. They're simply racist. If they are not ignoring such expressions, apologists for Marx will even try and whitewash them. In a 1942 Soviet English language publication of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, Selected Correspondence, 1846 to 1895, such terminology could not be ignored, and the following note cited by Diane Paul in the Interest of Civilization, Marxist Views of Race and Culture in the 19th Century, Journal of the History of Ideas, 1981, was included. Get this, boys and girls, this is with reference to the use of the word nigger, which occurs in this book, Marx uses the word while living in England in the last century. The word does not have the same connotation as it has now in the U.S. and should be read as Negro whenever it occurs in the text. The excuse seems to be along the lines of, yes, a racist term is used, but pretend that a non-racist term was used instead. It is a simply ludicrous excuse and exposes the depth to which apologists of Marx will sink. It was in his article, The Russian Loan, published in the New York Daily Tribune on January 4, 1856, that the grotesque anti-Semitism of Karl Marx's writings was in full display. Thus we find every tyrant backed by a Jew, as is every pope by a Jesuit. In truth, the cravings of oppressors would be hopeless, and the practicability of war out of the question if there were not an army of Jesuits to smother thoughts and a handful of Jews to ransack the pockets. The real work is done by the Jews and can only be done by them, as they monopolize the machinery of loan-mongering mysteries by concentrating their energies upon the barter trade and securities. Here and there and everywhere that a little capital courts investment. There's ever one of these little Jews ready to make a little suggestion or place a little bit of a loan. The smartest highwayman in the Abruzzi is not better posted up about the local and the hard cash in a traveler's valise or the pocket than those Jews about any loose capital in the hands of a trader. The language spoken smells strongly of Babel, and the perfume which otherwise pervades the place is no means of a choice kind. Thus do these loans, which are a curse to the people, a ruin to the holders, and a danger to the governments, become a blessing to the house of the children of Judah. This Jew organization of loan mongers is as dangerous to the people as the aristocratic organizations of landowners. The fortunes amassed by these loan mongers are immense. but the wrongs and sufferings thus entailed on the people and the encouragement thus afforded to their oppressors still remain to be told. In fact, that 1855 years ago, Christ drove the Jewish money changers out of the temple, and that the money changers are our age enlisted on the side of tyranny, happen again chiefly to be Jews, is perhaps no more than a historical coincidence. The loan mongering of Jews of Europe, due only on a large and more obnoxious scale, what many others do on smaller and less significant. But it is only because the Jews are so strong that it is timely and expedient to expose and stigmatize their organization. Hey, he'd have been good friends with Hitler. Well, you can't deny or argue against what he said there. You can, everybody, the right wing says they hate Karl Marx, but Karl Marx said a lot of good things. And about capital. He's right about capital, but the application of something to replace capital becomes a problem. A Marxist website has provided a list of articles written by Karl Marx between 1852 and 1861 for the New York Daily Tribune. It does not surprise me that the Russian loan does not appear on this list. When apologists for Marx's anti-Semitism run out of explanations, they simply ignore his words. Well, there you go. So, he was more of a good guy than you think. And I got that book, A World Without Jews, here, I think. I'm going to have to double check. I might be wrong about that. I've got the book, but I don't think... Maybe he didn't write it. Now that I think about it, I think that was a pro-Jew book with an anti-Jew title. Now, if you want to see this in print, you go to TPM, that's ThomasPaulMaryOnline.com. It's called The Philosopher's Magazine Online. I also have a book in my library that is all the letters between Karl Marx and Frederick Engels during the Civil War. Marx was very interested in the Civil War, and he had quite a bit of empathy to the white poor workers in the South. He was not a friend of slavery, that's for sure, because that's a form of capitalism. But on the other hand, there was quite a bit of empathy for the white, poor Southerner. It's something that's interesting to read. These are just a collection of personal letters. Well, before we get too upset with ISIS and their administration of law, maybe we ought to look at the Jews from the Jews' own mouths about what they have been involved in, even up until modern times. Over the last few weeks, Daf Yomi readers, that's a magazine in Israel, have followed the debates of Tractate Ketubot about how to punish a man who rapes or seduces an unmarried young girl. In most circumstances, his penalty involves paying a fine to the girl's father and offering to marry the girl himself. But what if a girl, while she is betrothed to one man, has sexual relations with another? What if her punishment or fine or forced marriage? Alas, the answer we learned this week from chapter 4 of the Ketubot is very different. In accordance with the explicit statement in Deuteronomy 22, verse 21, a bride who is found not to be a virgin on her wedding night is stoned to death. Whoa, that's not ISIS talk, that's Jews. Quote, they shall bring out the maiden to the door of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her with stones so she will die, because she has done a wanton deed in Israel to play the harlot in her father's house. Wow. The Talmud in Ketubot 4:4a applies its usual common sense logic to this law. What if the bride's father doesn't have his own house so that she can't be stoned at the door of her father's house? In that case, we learn, she is executed via stoning as a requirement that she is to be executed at the entrance to her father's house is stated only for the mitzvah, but is not an indispensable requirement. A little later, we learn that the location and manner of the woman's execution depends on her age and the status at the time of her transgression is discovered. If she is found to have been unfaithful after she is already married, one stones her at the entrance of her father's house as though to say, "See what you have brought up." If she is exposed while still living in her father's house during her betrothal, then one stones her at the entrance of the gate of the city. See, you can get stoned any place. These punishments are reserved for a young woman, a ne'era, which, as we saw last week, the Talmud defines strictly as a girl between the age of 12 and 12 and a half. If, however, her infidelity is exposed only once, she is older than that and legally a grown woman. Then she's not stoned but strangled. Yeah. A little more humanitarian there. We won't stone her, we'll strangle her. The natural response to a passage like this is outrage at the sexual double standard between men and women and at the sheer cruelty of the punishment. Stoning, strangling, flogging today, these are the kinds of brutality we associate with the ISIS. It would be gratifying to feel that there are no part of our heritage as Jews, but the Bible and the Talmud do not allow that kind of gratification. The truth is, in Deuteronomy, we find the same kind of panic about female sexuality, the same need to control women's feelings and behavior that to modern people in the West is one of the hallmarks of barbarism. The core of the matter is laid bare in the Mishnah on Kebutu 46b, where we learn a father has authority over his daughter until her marriage, whereupon her husband takes over the authority. A woman under Talmudic law is not a legally competent individual, but the responsibility of a man. Isn't that called slavery? Reading Seder Nashim, the division of the Talmud that deals with the laws relating to women, involves coming up against this kind of thinking again and again. Seder Moab, the first division of the Talmud, which deals with the Jewish calendar and holidays, containing plenty of foreign and obsolete ideas, yet somehow they did not provoke the same kind of indignation. The premise of all the Shabbat laws, for instance, is that deliberate desecration of Shabbat is also punishable by stoning. Well, they like to get stoned, those Israelites. Today, many, maybe most, American Israeli Jews violate Shabbat without a second thought. And we do not get angry when we learn that we would be liable to death under biblical law. Why is it so different when it comes to laws about women and sex? The reason, I think, is that the modern West's emancipation from ritual is much older and better established than its emancipation from patriarchy. It has been four centuries since Catholics and Protestants murdered each other over matters like the transubstantiation of the Eucharist, or whether a priest should face towards the congregation or away from it during Mass. Modern Europe and Americans were largely built around the idea that such religious issues belonged to the private sphere, which doesn't mean that they are not important, but does mean that they are not subject to compulsion. In the Jew context, Moses Mendelssohn, in his famous 1783 book, Jerusalem, already arrived at the conclusion that there should be no compulsion in matters of religion. The community, argued, had no right to excommunicate dissenters. Today, for almost all Jews except those born into isolated ultra-Orthodox or Haredi communities, the Jewish practice presents itself as a matter of choice You can choose to be stoned or not stoned. No. You can choose to be highly observant or barely observant. And no worldly authority can compel you to do otherwise. So technically, under their rules, they can still stone the women and get stoned too. When it comes to gender relations, however, things are very different. It's only about 50 years since the feminist movement and the sexual revolution made sexual egalitarianism a central part of the liberal creed. Many Americans, especially the most religious, still resist this development, seeing it as a sign of decadence and immorality. That is why the abortion issue is one of the most divisive in American politics, because it relates directly to a woman's sovereignty over their bodies. When we see female genital mutilation in Africa or the veiling of women in Saudi Arabia or Iran, we recognize a way of thinking about gender and sex that we have only recently and incompletely overcome. No wonder we define ourselves so strongly in contrast, so that the French, for instance, made it illegal for girls to come to school veiled. This is a culture war that is still ongoing, both within Western culture and between it and others. For me, at least, that's the writer, it does not feel necessary to bring this culture war to the Talmud. While I recognize that the way the rabbis thought about gender is oppressive and patriarchal, I don't see that as for a reason not to read the Talmud at all. I think there are three reasons for this reaction. First, of course, is that I'm a man, and so I am perhaps less personally affronted by what I read in the Kabbat about women and what it might be. Well, anyhow, that's enough of that. Anyhow, isn't it strange? They write, like all the Christians say, the Bible's my book. That's what I go by. That's what I cling to. That's what I actually reverence in the whole bit. And it's all in there. All this stuff is in the Old Testament and even some in the New. You know, remember when Christ cursed the fig tree for not having figs there when he wanted to pick them and eat them? He cursed the tree. That's pretty wild. Anyhow, religious people are hypocrites if they're going to follow the rules of their book. They should follow them every dot and tittle, whatever you say, and follow everything. Women give you any trouble, just stone them at the gate. Yeah, that's in the Old Testament that you've got in your church. Anyhow, that's enough of that dwaddle. Of course, was a Jewish writer. So it sounds to me like the Islamics, Muslims, are far more patriotic to the Quran than Christians and Jews are to their Bible, their book. I don't know whether I told you the other day, but there's three Mein Kampfs went on sale the other day in San Francisco or Los Angeles. And they're expected to receive, you know, maybe 20, 30 grand. But the funny part about it is, it's not funny really, it's a Jew that owns them. Making money off Uncle Adolf, yeah. And now they're selling off Hitler paintings. Yeah, they've got an auction coming up. And the painting by Hitler is expected to start the bids at $30,000. It's a 1912 watercolor, still life. Very pretty picture. They've got it here on the internet. I'm not going to read all the stuff that goes with it because it's more of the same Jewish dribble. We can give Hitler hell and point out all his mistakes and how he fucked up everything. But I don't like to hear it from the Jews. Now, Hitler's toilet is in Florence, New Jersey. I guess it's not for sale. Anyhow, a guy bought this auto repair shop, and it was in there 20 years ago. Well, I think I'd rather have Hitler's toilet than a picture, because I could sit on that toilet and maybe get some interesting thoughts. I could be maybe quite creative sitting on Hitler's toilet. but I'm afraid it's a little out of my price range. Don't forget Hitler's yacht. I think it's still down in Florida someplace. I think it's been sold a couple of times. Oh, yeah, the U.S. ended up in, his yacht ended up in the hands of a New Jersey shipyard owner, Harry Doan, who illegally charged visitors 25 cents to board and tour Hitler's yacht. I don't see why they could make it illegal. However, according to Glass, both Doan and the federal government wanted to prevent the ship from becoming a memorial to Hitler, and so it was scrapped in Doan's salvage yard in the early 1950s up there in New Jersey. A lot of things happened in New Jersey. Well, we know that if people want to worship a person in the historical past, they're going to do it. It don't make any difference whether you got the toilet or the yacht or what. So that's silly to destroy stuff just because somebody might use it to worship Hitler. Believe me, there's a lot of people around the country that would make a trip there to New Jersey if they could touch that toilet. And if that toilet has never been cleaned, there might be some DNA left. We could reconstruct a Hitler again, if you please. Well, I looked up that article about the big meeting of the so-called neo-Nazis in St. Petersburg. But it didn't give enough information. And, of course, it didn't give a list of who was there. But I found some more stuff here today. And let's see what it says. European neo-Nazis hold meeting in Russia. Well, I don't think the Russians are very happy with neo-Nazis, if they were neo-Nazis, because they're sure not happy with them in Ukraine. Yeah. Anyhow, MEPS from Greece's neo-Nazi Golden Dawn, and Udo Voigt from the German neo-Nazi NPD. The NPD is nothing but a right-wing conservative political party. I think you're stretching it to call them a Nazi organization. We're among the participants in the pro-Kremlin International Conservative Forum in St. Petersburg. According to the War Forum's website, about 400 people from 15 different countries gathered on Sunday, the 22nd of March, to back a resolution on scrapping EU sanctions against Russia and protecting Christian traditions. Oh boy. What's Christian traditions? That can be anything. Other participants included nationalist parties from Belgium, Bulgaria, Denmark, Italy, Spain, Sweden, and the UK. The resolution, while supporting Russia's annexation of the Crimea, asked the USA and its allies to stop the creation of puppet anti-national regimes in independent countries. Alessandra Kaufman, the foreign minister of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic, was reportedly also present. Among the list of points of support for Russia and broad criticism of the EU, it adds, "We are conservative forces." Conserving what? "Represented by an expert community based on the latest scientific data of population demographics capacities in our countries. In these processes, we won't be able to provide our people the worthy and good future." In other words, with all the numb-nut, idiot, non-whites coming in from all over the world, we got a big problem, got to get rid of them. That's Tommy's type talk. It describes NATO as an instrument of dictatorship of military strength. Well, hell, you didn't have to go to all the way to St. Petersburg to figure that out. It costs a lot of money to travel. The forum described itself as a scientific conference. Sounds to me it was more political, and was organized by the Russian National Cultural Center People's House. According to Bulgarian media outlet Novinite, The event organizer includes Russia's Rodina Party. Formed in 2003, the party lists Russia's deputy PM Sergei Rogozin as a member. Well, that kind of stuff turns some people on. They get excited. They go there and they glad hand each other, and they probably didn't seek Heil, but means nothing except to the CIA trying to put mud in the water. People like that. I don't see it makes any difference at all if these people go there and have these stupid little meetings. You want to have smart action, not stupid meetings. You know, the Black Ku Klux Klan up there in Chicago is working out averages about 8 murders a week, which is not as much as Detroit, but it's pretty bad. But, you know, there's a lot more than 8, because the cops have a clever way of covering it up. If a guy is, shot or somebody attacks him, and he doesn't die immediately and lingers on, they don't count that as a murder. The cops have found several ways to get around labeling a death a murder. And so they've got a lot more murders up in Chicago than they're subscribing to. So anyhow, but Detroit is even worse. Well, here we go, moving towards another war. A U.S. House passes resolution to arm the Ukraine. The U.S. House of Representatives Monday passed a resolution urging President Obama to deliver, quote, lethal defensive weapons, unquote. Lethal defensive weapons? Well, if they're lethal, they could be aggressive weapons, too. To Ukraine to defend its sovereignty and territorial integrity. The vote took place days after the U.S. military chief Martin Dempsey said he would absolutely consider such aid. And all your, especially your Republican congressmen and senators, are going to be right on board with all this crap. They're warmongers, and half the Democrats, too. You know, the right wing over there in Europe are skinheads. They're arguing about playing their music, but the state looks at it as a revolutionary act, playing a band, playing music. The police, this was in Holland, the police in the municipality put to a stop a performance by German neo-Nazi band Category C in Hochbergen this weekend. A police spokesman told the NRC, Category C is an extreme, way out there, way out there right-wing band whose music is aimed at football hooligans. The band members belong to a group of hooligans of the football club Werder Bremen. The band wanted to perform in the Netherlands this past weekend, and the band's manager had been trying to book a venue for weeks. Now, you know, this has absolutely nothing to do with civil disobedience or activism that gets someplace or anything. It's just having the music. You know, it's wild lyrics. Everybody kids themselves about, we're going to take over, kill everybody tomorrow, blank, blank, blank on my guitar, you know, which does nothing. Some people make some money off of it. I notice their CDs now are getting higher than hell from these skinhead bands. And I'm sure the bands are not getting much of that money. But this whole right-wing game that's played over there in Europe, I feel no attraction to it whatsoever. The police and Mayor Michael Cibone of the Twente municipality, Losser, sent out warnings about the band's plans to perform in the province. When it turned out the band had a performance plan in Hochbergen, the police and municipality had an intensive contact with the organizers, after which the concert was canceled and the whole party returned to Germany. No one was arrested. Boy, the system said, boy, did we show them guys. We showed those bald-headed guys. We chased them back to Germany. Performances by Category C, who also goes under the alias Hungry Wolves, usually attracted about 300 spectators. fans receive an email about the location of the concert a few hours before the concert starts. Venue owners usually do not realize they have been booked by the infamous neo-Nazi band, believing that their venue was booked for a wedding or birthday celebration until the event starts. Well, believe me, they don't want to do that. They have to do that so they can try to play their music. Yeah. Well, anyhow, that's showbiz, baby. They're so afraid that they chase little bands around. There was supposed to be a video of this, but they do their best to kill these videos. Said this video is no longer available due to a copyright claim by Sony/ATV Music Publishing Germany, GmbH. Yeah, those capitalists, they know how to operate. Here's an earth-shaking piece of news. Neo-Nazis, black separatists, skinheads, and a rock band that pens racist lyrics operated out of Lehigh Valley in northwestern New Jersey in 2014, according to a report issued this month by civil rights organization, the Southern Millionaires Law Center, names four hate groups in the region on its new hate groups map. The center uses the map to bring light to a very dark issue facing America. Mark Hairlip Potok, senior fellow at the center, said Monday, quote, "Our aim is to educate the general public and pick their pocket," Potok said. "I think the vast majority of Americans really have no idea how many of these groups exist." Do you mean the South Americans too, all the way down to southern tip of Argentina? They're Americans. There are three that operated in Allentown alone last year. They had their meeting in a phone booth, of course, as usual. The center's map identified them as the Eastern Hammerskins, a racist skinhead group. Oh, my God. The Israelite Church of God and Jesus Christ, a black separatist group. And Poker Face, a band producing music, the center says, is racist. Oh. The fourth local hate group, according to the center's map, is a chapter of the neo-Nazi National Socialist Movement in Holland Township, just south of Interstate 78 in Hunterdon County. Still looking for media. Holland Township is the hometown of Heath Campbell, a self-proclaimed neo-Nazi who named his child Adolf Hitler and complained in 2008 when a Greenwich Township supermarket refused to decorate a birthday cake with that name. The right wing is so pathetic. Potok said he does not know if there's a connection between Campbell and the National Socialist Movement group that operated out of Holland Township, but he didn't rule it out. Quote, "This is now the largest neo-Nazi formation in the United States," unquote. He said, of the National Socialism Movement, oh, there you go, which also has chapters elsewhere in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. These chapters, of course, it's just like the old days with the Nazi Party, usually two or three guys in a post office box. The nature of hate groups, which often operate underground and sometimes have little or no footprint on the Internet, makes them difficult to track down, according to Potok, and it ain't fair. Some of the groups are tiny and only remain active for a short period of time. You got that right. Then they're off into something else. If the center can't find evidence that a group was active during any part of 2014, it won't make the year's map, he said. I don't see Morris Dees and Potok, I don't see how they can do all this with a straight face. They're bringing tons of money in from the little old ladies, scaring the shit out of them that the Hollywood Nazis are coming. Give us money, and we'll try to stop them. That's likely the case of a local hate group called Aryan Terror Brigade, which operates out of Flemington, and appeared on the center's hate group map as recently as 2013. Boy, I'll bet you they're rough. Aryan Terror Brigade. Quote, "We have to show some kind of activity for the year," he said, "or we won't get the contributions like we need to keep us going in our high lifestyle, like Morris D's wife in her plastic dress." If we don't see them doing anything at all, we don't list them. But the trouble is, the little old ladies quit sending us money. But that activity could be limited to only a portion of the year, so it's conceivable that a particular group had already disbanded by the time the center compiles all its research from the previous year and puts out the finished map. Again, we've got to have more groups. Get out there and help the Southern Millionaires Law Center start more little groups, because they need the exposure, they need the money. For instance, there appears to be no record of the Israelite Church of God in Jesus Christ currently operating out of Allentown. That's the black separatists. No contact information on the group could be found online. That was one Amos and Andy guy out there, you know. They hired him to say that's what he was. The other two suspected hate groups in Allentown, the Eastern Hammerskins and Poker Face, do have a presence on the internet. Oh, well. Run for your lives. They're on the internet. The Eastern Hammerskins website has little in the way of information about the group and lacks a phone number or email contact information. Whoa. Paul Topeat of Poker Face, which has a website that appears to be dormant since last year, said his band is still active. He disputed the Southern Millionaires Law Center's classification of his band as a hate group. He called the center a race-agitating group. They're trying to create race tensions, man, Topet said of the center. They're not trying to create race solutions. He also challenged a reporter to find any lyrics in Poker Face's music that are racist. Well, whoa. See, you know, that's the problem with the right wing. Most of the right wing guys will be racist at one time, and then they're not racist the next time. Me, a racist? I love Negroes. I love everybody. I just have this swastika on my forehead for fun. Topeat said the group does speak out aggressively against illegal immigration, but supports minorities who immigrate legally. He's just another goddamn right-wing conservative. He's a conservative. He said the center and similar groups target Poker Face because the band is white. Oh, well, that's your mistake. It's conservative and they're Christian, he said. Poker Face is very God, family, country-oriented, he said. Goddamn, I'm glad I got out of the right wing. I can't stand it. Drives me crazy. It drives me crazy, man.
Here come old bad news. Well, bad news travels like wildfire. Good news travels slow. They all call me wildfire, 'cause everybody knows I'm bad news. Everywhere I go, always getting in trouble, and I'm leaving little girls that hate to see me go. They tried to hang me in Oakland, and they did in Francisco, but I wouldn't choke, I broke the rope. And they had to let me go, 'cause I'm bad news. Everywhere I go, oh, oh, oh. Always getting in trouble, and leaving little girls that hate to see me go. Now, from north to south, to east to west, the story is the same. from one state to another. I have to change my name 'cause I'm bad news. Everywhere I go. Always getting in trouble and leaving little girls that sure hate to see me go. Well, now I pick peaches in Georgia. I lumberjacked in Maine. I've been hired, fired, and jailed any town you can name, 'cause I'm bad news. Everywhere I go, always getting into trouble and leaving little girls that hate to see me go.